From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Pragmatism and principle are dividing the GOP. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Ronald Reagan's advice to party colleagues was never speak ill of another Republican, but some are now talking of civil war. Karl Rove has promised big money to oppose GOP primary candidates he calls unelectable because they're too extreme to be Democrats. That's caused a Tea Party backlash against a Washington establishment accused of clinging to power by compromising on principle. We'll hear about a party divided on many issues and on how to capture the Senate in next year's elections. On Reporter's Notebook later on, an asteroid that could take out a major city is coming our way, but astronomers say not to worry. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. In response to the President's State of the Union speech this week, Florida Senator Marco Rubio spoke for mainstream Republicans. But the Tea Party Express had its own voice, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Today we'll hear about a party divided over pragmatism and principle. On Reporter's Notebook, the International Space Station is safe, and so is planet Earth. But astronomers are paying attention to an asteroid that will pass inside the orbits of GPS satellites tomorrow. We'll hear about that. First, this news update. Delta and Northwest became the world's largest airline in 2008. United and Continental overtook them just 2 years ago. Now American Airlines and U.S. Airways have agreed to be even bigger, with a merger worth $11 billion. Mary Jane Crader is airlines reporter for Bloomberg News based in Atlanta. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
How many big airlines are there going to be left?
Well, in the U.S., only three. Three of them that will have full-service first class and coach cabins that also fly transoceanic. It'll be United, Continental, Delta, and now the new American. And we've got a number of smaller carriers, JetBlue, Southwest, et cetera, but really only three full-service ones now.
How do they compare in size to other nationals and other airlines, rather, in other countries?
They're very close in size. American leapfrogs United by just a tiny little bit, and Delta's a very close on their heels as well. The International Airlines Group out of London, that's the parent of British Airways, is also very, very large, and they kind of round out the top four globally.
How do you determine size? Is it by the number of planes or the number of routes or what?
Typically, the industry measures it by traffic, which is miles flown by paying passengers. And you could measure it by revenue. You could measure it by a number of aircraft. But typically, it's measured by traffic. And on that basis, the new American will be the largest.
How do you come up with this figure that it's all worth $11 billion? How does that pan out?
Taking into account the projected market capitalization of the merged company and assuming some of the other assets, debt on the books, that sort of thing, brings us to about 11.
Will this mean less competition? Will that mean higher airfares?
Market by market, the analysts that we've talked to expect the airlines might need to divest a little bit of service here and there, possibly at Washington Reagan National Airport, where they control about half of the service. But other than that, they really don't have a whole lot of overlap. They both serve some of the New York area, the New York area airports, but their hubs are in very different cities. U.S. Airways might end up pruning a little bit at their Phoenix hub because Los Angeles and Dallas, the two the American hubs in that area, could take some of that traffic instead.
Will there be less service to smaller cities, which I think has been the case when some of these other mergers have occurred?
Yeah, the airlines say that they won't cut service to any cities. We might see some reductions, though. That tends to be par for the course in past mergers. Delta has about 70% less service to Cincinnati now than it did before the merger. United Continental has about 40% less service to its Cleveland hub now. That's been partly a function of fuel prices and the recession, not just the merger itself. But, yeah, analysts expect that they'll probably do some pruning. We did a survey of analysts analysts, and the consensus estimate was about 4%.
What about the inside stories about the executives involved and who helped to put the deal together and who tried to stop it?
Well, it's a fascinating story. Doug Parker, the CEO of U.S. Airways, started this wave of mergers back in 2005. At the time, he was the CEO of America West Holdings, and U.S. Airways, they did a kind of a reverse merger when U.S. Airways was in bankruptcy, and he remained CEO of that carrier. And he's tried along the way to do several mergers that failed. He tried to go after Delta when they were in bankruptcy back in 2007. He tried twice with United and was rebuffed both times. United, of course, picked Continental instead. And fast forward to today, here he is pulling off this merger that makes him CEO of the world's largest airline. Interestingly, he and American's current CEO, Tom Horton, used to be colleagues back at American about 25 years ago. They sat in nearby cubicles when they were in the financial planning department.
Watch out for the guy down the hall. What about the relationship with unions, particularly the pilots' union, as American and U.S. Airways merge?
Well, the American had a real hard time getting any kind of contract with its own pilots before the merger talks were underway, and they struggled for years, a big fight during and in bankruptcy, and it just was not going anywhere. U.S. Airways learned from past mistakes. They learned that you've got to have labor support for a deal, so they approached the pilots and other work groups and got some tentative agreements in place that got labor on their side, and that really helped play an important role in this deal. So they do have a protocol for sort of an interim contract with the pilots as they work out the deals in the merger.
And does American have more prestige as U.S. Airways, sort of the little guy in the deal?
Yeah, absolutely. American is by far the most well-known brand globally. It's been around since the dawn of commercial aviation. It's got ties to Lindbergh and the mail route era, and it's just a big name. It was the original legacy carrier. It was the world's largest carrier for decades, and they do have a lot of brand equity.
Okay. All right. Once again, American Airlines and U.S. Airways merging to form the world's largest airline. Mary Jane Cradier, good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
In a moment, pragmatism and principle are dividing the GOP. To the point.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The Civil War has begun. That's according to conservative David Bossie of Citizens United, blogging this week on Breitbart.com and referring to a Republican Party now sharply divided after failing to take the White House last year and divided, too, over how to capture the Senate in next year's elections. Ron Brownstein is political director for the National Journal Group, and he's also author of The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America. Ron Brownstein, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here, Warren.
You're talking about a somewhat different civil war than David Bossie.
Yeah, I am. I'm talking about the kind of systemic trend, in that book anyway, the systemic trend toward a more polarization between the parties
right. And
unity within them. And I think, David Bossie, the way he's framing it is, I think, being a little overly inflammatory, because that is basically how the activists, a kind of the forward edge of each party's coalition, make their money and fund their organizations with a sense of siege. There are differences in the Republican Party, I think we saw that very clearly in the presidential primaries, and we saw it in several of the state-level primaries for Senate and so forth. But you could overstate it. I mean, there's a core of centered belief in the Republican Party, a core of ideological, demographic center to the party that I think is very real today.
And that, you think, then encompasses both the so-called establishment Republicans in Washington and the Tea Party Republicans?
Well, I mean, there's first of all, the Republicans, in many ways, are more homogenous. The coalition is more homogenous than the Democratic coalition. You know, the Republican over 90% of the voters in the Republican primaries, presidential primaries last year, were white. Over 60% were over 50. There's a very high preponderance of regular churchgoers. Nearly half of them are evangelical Christians. And 80% of Republicans self-identify as conservative, as compared to only about 50 to 55% of Democrats who identify as liberal. So in the broad sense, you know, it is a more unified coalition. It has a lot more similarity, you know, but within that, obviously, you do have this kind of question of tone and degree that has broken out in a number of these fights between kind of the Tea Party, identified as the Tea Party, with a lot of overlap, by the way, of evangelical Christians, and a kind of more establishment Republicans. You saw during the presidential primaries that Mitt Romney did very well among what I have called the managerial wing of the Republican Party, who tend to be college graduates, more affluent, and more secular. And the other side, the populist side of the party, cast around for an alternative, so they found Rick Santorum and kind of stuck with him. But Romney did win, and in the end, 90% of Republicans, you know, voted, over 90% of Republicans voted for him.
On the other hand, not enough Democrats did to elect him, and that's really what's caused, it seems to me, what appears to be at least a strategic difference between two groups. Let's hear more about the PAC, formed by American Crossroads, called the Conservative Victory Project, and what its goals are.
Well, the what they've done, what Karl Rove has done with American Crossroads, is basically say we're going to go into primaries with this new PAC as a counterweight to the conservative groups that have been spending against, in some case, incumbents, the Club for Growth, Americans for Prosperity, and others. And you know, Warren, I was thinking, you know, you mentioned the book, The Second Civil War. This is actually a dispute with a kind of a long history and trajectory here, because really the pioneer in this area is the group called the Club for Growth, which was the first to invest in primary challenges, first to sitting Republican House members, then in 2004 with Pat Toomey against Arlen Specter, to sitting senators, and as chief political advisor in the Bush White House, Rove was very resistant to that and very opposed to what they were doing. And, you know, there has become, and I think largely because of the internet and the ability to raise money, ideological money nationally, Senate primaries have become much more common. I mean, four sitting senators have been denied renomination by their parties in the last two cycles. That's as many as were denied renomination from 1982 to 2008. So, you know, there is a kind of there's a clear trend here, and it's the only thing surprising about this is that it's taken so long for the Rove-type response to happen.
Ron Brownstein, again, with the National Journal Group. There also, of course, were two responses to the President's State of the Union address. Let's hear just a little bit of each one of them. Marco Rubio, the Republican senator from Florida, was speaking on behalf, it is thought, of the establishment Republicans, the so-called managerial Republicans, I think is your term. Let's hear a bit of what he had to say.
We don't have to raise taxes to avoid the president's devastating cuts to our military. Republicans have passed a plan that replaces these cuts with responsible spending reforms.
And here is Rand Paul, a U.S. senator from Kentucky, speaking on behalf of the Tea Party.
It's time Democrats admit that not every dollar spent on domestic programs is sacred. And it's time Republicans, myself included, realize that military spending is not immune to waste and fraud.
So back to Ron Brownstein. That's a pretty interesting difference on military spending.
It is. And, you know, in fact, you know, as we're seeing it right now, as we're living through this debate about whether we're going to go through the sequester, the cuts on the military side, let's go back a step. The sequester was designed to compel the two sides to reach an agreement. It was never intended to be imposed. It was supposed to create conditions that were so unacceptable to each side that they would find a comprehensive agreement more attractive. Well, the part that was supposed to get Republicans to the tables were the defense cuts. And what I think has surprised some Democrats is how many, not all, but how many congressional Republicans are saying, well, you know what? I'm willing to take these defense cuts if that's the price of getting the reductions, the parallel reductions in domestic discretionary spending. So what Rand Paul said in that clip is actually being reflective in the posture of probably half the Republican caucus in the House.
Ron Brownstein again, once more with the National Journal Group. Jonathan Colleggio is spokesperson for American Crossroads. That's the super PAC founded by Karl Rove, now setting up the Conservative Victory Project. Jonathan Colleggio, good to have you on us. Our program. We can hear from you rather than talking about you. Good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
This has been advertised as a way of avoiding what happened in several Senate races last year, where in primaries, Republicans that were very, very far to the right made statements that once they got the nominations were used against them by Democrats who defeated them. Tell us, what is the strategy of the Conservative Victory Project?
Well, first, I wouldn't say it's just what happened in the last election cycle. I mean, we've looked back at our efforts and the efforts of the Republican Party and conservative groups broadly over the last two election cycles, and we look back and we see about 4 to 7 U.S. Senate seats that were lost, not because of the messages that we had as a party or as a conservative movement, but because of the messengers who were delivering those messages. And it happened. I don't want to turn this into something about it only being candidates of the far right. We had candidate quality issues on all sides of the spectrum, from moderates as well as those on the conservative line. So looking at the fact that we've lost seats, not because of our message as a party, but because of the quality of candidates we have, either candidates who had skeletons in the closet, candidates who were undisciplined as messengers, or candidates who just had a complete inability to fundraise in a general election. We looked at that and we said, what we need to do is look at how we're nominating candidates in primaries. And our goal with this Conservative Victory Project is to nominate the most conservative candidate possible in the primary who is also capable of winning in the general. That's what we're trying to do.
So that's your explanation. The Tea Party Patriots have a somewhat different view of all of this. The co-founder of that organization is Jenny Beth Martin. The Tea Party Patriots have recently created the Tea Party Patriots Citizen Fund. And Ms. Martin, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Is this a direct response to the Conservative Victory Project?
No, it's not a direct response. The timing was purely coincidental, but we'd had this in the works for several weeks now, but we were planning to launch last week or this week, as it was, and we launched because we have not been engaged in elections directly. We have not done any endorsements up until this point, and now our local coordinators say they want us to get involved and to be able to raise funds that go directly to elections, so that's what we're doing now.
Before you came aboard, we were talking with Ron Brownstein, and I introduced the program by beginning with the phrase, "The Civil War Has Begun," from David Bossie of Citizens United, who says that the creation of these two funds is illustrative of the fact that there really is a war going on between what he refers to as the establishment of the party, the people who want to cling to power, as opposed to Tea Partiers who are standing more on principle. Is that a distinction that you agree with?
Well, it certainly appears that way. And the real fact of the matter is our Tea Party movement got started because the government spending is out of control, and too many people in Washington think they know what's best for the rest of the country. When you have people in Washington who are consultants coming in and saying, oh, we're going to pick the people who are the most conservative, who can win, rather than trusting the people in a state to pick their own representative, it's the same kind of problem that we're facing when Washington says, we know what's best for your local community, and we don't need your elected officials making decisions. We'll just make all the decisions for you.
What about what happened last year in Missouri and in Indiana? In Missouri, Congressman Aiken said that you can't get pregnant from legitimate rape. That was used against him. He lost the race in the general election. Murdoch said that pregnancy resulting from rape is a gift from God. That cost him in Indiana. Is that an example, Jenny Beth Martin, of quality issues with candidates?
I think that both of those candidates had problems, but you also had candidates in North Dakota and Montana, George Allen in Virginia, Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin. The list goes on and on and on of candidates who the establishment would have said, these are candidates who can win. We can start right at the top of the ticket. everyone in Washington, D.C. was saying that we needed to have Romney as the nominee because he was the most electable. That didn't work out so well.
Jonathan Colicchio, back to you with American Crossroads, setting up the Conservative Victory Project. What do you say to that?
Well, like I said, I mean, we looked at our efforts over the last couple election cycles, and we looked at everyone's efforts over the election cycles. And I agree that there are definitely, as I said earlier, quote-unquote establishment candidates who have not run good campaigns. It's a problem that we're having everywhere. It's not just among Tea Party folks. It's also among establishment folks. The difference, and this is the reason why I think it was such a flashpoint in the news media, is that the kind of the more spectacular cases of candidates breaking down were the ones that were on the more right side of the spectrum. I mean, Connie Mack in Florida ran a race that instead of being, you know, having one spectacular moment of self-destruction, it was kind of a slow-motion self-destruction that happened over the course of months. But we really want to bring up the candidate quality bar for everyone across the board. That's why we said from the very beginning, this is not about, a Tea Party against the establishment. For us, this is about candidate quality, and that's agnostic, really, of ideology. We want better conservative candidates everywhere.
Let me go back to Ron Brownstein, again, with the National Journal Group. How do you read the conversation that we're hearing here?
It's interesting. I think if I'm recalling my history correctly, Jonathan Colicchio and Karl Rove are committing themselves to William Buckley's famous dictum at the National Review of supporting the most conservative candidate who can win. Look, I mean, I think that, you know, we are in a period where there is an enormous amount of money in politics, where there is more ideological homogeneity in each party's coalition. And when you take those two things together, you're going to have more contested primaries. And I think that, you know, the challenge for the Rove effort here is that there are roughly 80% of GOP primary voters identify themselves as conservatives. And in many cases, the candidate who can position themselves as the most conservative will have an advantage, especially if they can frame the race through those kind of ideological lens. I mean, I don't think they're guaranteed success every time they intervene here. But I do think, as I said before, it was inevitable that there would be a response when you have seen these, I think largely because of the internet and the ability to raise money nationally, the ideological groups in each party have achieved greater ability to influence primaries. And I think it is not surprising and almost inevitable that a more kind of establishment-oriented response would develop.
What about the Tea Party response?
Well, I mean, you know, look, I mean, I think that is, as I said, I mean, I think that, you know, this strength of a movement like the Tea Party to me is a reflection of the larger sorting out of the parties that we've gone through over the last generation. And each party is more ideologically homogenous than it used to be, with Republicans considerably further along that scale than Democrats. But there are obviously variations of degree. But the Tea Party, I think, is just, to me, the modern manifestation of what we called in the 90s the Leave Us Alone Coalition. Grover Norquist christened as in the backlash against Bill Clinton. I mean, there is roughly 35% of the country that is deeply, deeply ideologically skeptical of any kind of activist role for government, tends to be older, whiter, more rural, and that is going to find an expression. What the Tea Party has done is kind of channel and organize that in a way that has had lasting impact, especially in Republican primaries.
Okay, Ron Brownstein again, political director of the National Journal Group, author of The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America. Thanks very much to you.
Thank you.
I will continue this conversation with Jonathan Colicchio and Jenny Beth Martin, who are on the front lines, and we'll talk to others as well as the program goes on Reporter's Notebook later, tomorrow's close call with an asteroid and what others could mean in the future. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the divisions within the Republican Party and how extreme they are, how divided the party really is. I want to go back to Jenny Beth Martin, the co-founder of the Tea Party Patriots, who has recently created the Tea Party Patriots Citizen Fund. You mentioned earlier that some of the so-called establishment candidates, Allen in Virginia, Thompson in Wisconsin, and of course Romney nationwide, had failed to win. Do you intend to spend money on behalf of candidates more conservative than they, candidates that might be supported by the Conservative Victory Project started by Karl Rove and Jonathan Collegio?
Well, I don't know what candidates Karl Rove and Jonathan are planning to fund, so I can't answer that. What I can say is that we don't even call ourselves conservative with Tea Party Patriots. We stand for three things: fiscal responsibility, constitutionally limited government, and free markets. And people who support those values will, and have a proven track record of supporting them, will have support of our supporters around the country and have had that kind of support. With our PAC, we're looking at doing that. We also are going to point out the people who haven't been adhering to those values. Our country's nearly $17 trillion in debt, and we're concerned about how we're going to actually solve the problem and begin to pay down the debt eventually. We are going to build a ground game, and we're going to make sure that our activists around the country are able to do what the Republican Party has failed to do in recent election cycles, and that is build the ground game, engage in precinct organization, and make sure that we can actually get the vote out. And it's one thing where I think that our organization can fill a void that's missing, and we're going to do it, and we're going to do it advocating our values.
Back to Jonathan Collegio with American Crossroads, the super PAC founded by Karl Rove, now setting up the Conservative Victory Project. Do you see yourself in competition with those candidates supported by the Tea Party Patriots and the Patriot Citizens Fund?
No, absolutely not. In fact, we would like to be working with, collaborating with groups like the Tea Party Patriots, as well as, you know, groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, anyone who's interested in getting the best candidates available. I mean, like you said, like Brownstein said earlier, you know, our goal is to institutionalize what we call the William F. Buckley rule, which is to elect the most conservative candidate in the primary who's also capable of winning the general. And one way to do that is to make sure that, you know, that folks are all on the same page. And I point to the example of Missouri in the 2012 elections where Todd Akin ended up winning the primary there. Before he had won, there was kind of a Donnybrook between the more establishment candidate, a businessman, I believe his name was John Bruner, and Sarah Steelman, who was kind of the more conservative person there. And while the moderate and the conservative, we were not involved in that, and while the moderate and conservative wing were slugging it out, Todd Akin kind of came up the middle. The Democrats actually supported Todd Akin, and he ended up winning the primary. And within a week, his candidacy is completely self-destructed. I think if there's one thing that we can all agree on as conservatives is that we should not be letting the Democrats choose our candidates for us. They did it so astutely in 2012 that I would suspect that that's something they're going to try to do again. So we really want to have as much collaboration and cooperation with all the outside groups as is possible.
Jenny Beth Martin, do you see this formula, the idea that you want to have the most conservative candidate who's capable of winning, as an invitation to compromise on basic conservative principles?
Well, what I see it as is when people look at all of the things and they're sitting there calculating numbers and going through and crunching numbers to decide who the candidate needs to be, we wind up with people like Romney, who was the messenger delivering the message, and he still was incapable of closing the deal.
Was that because he made too many compromises or because he was just a lousy candidate?
Well, I think part of it is because he took Obamacare off the table and he wouldn't even discuss it. And he had 60% of the American people who wanted the law repealed, and he couldn't even talk about it in his entire campaign. So he talked about it in very general, broad terms, but he would not get into specifics about it. We're looking for people who are going to solve the immediate problems facing our country and then return our country to a constitutionally limited government. That's what our country is about. We want freedom, and And we hope that we will get candidates who want that and who can persuade other people that that is the correct thing for them as Americans.
But would Santorum have made a better candidate, do you think, against the president than Romney did? Because he was able to speak out against Obamacare.
I can't go back and look and say who would have made the better candidate. Clearly, with all the other candidates, there were votes who were being split. There was no firm other alternative. So I cannot answer that. What I can say is that there were a lot of people who didn't want Romney as a nominee, yet after he was a nominee, they kept their mouth shut. They worked hard. They worked on our principles. They did what they could. And then as soon as the election was over, we see, in even 2 weeks before the election was over, consultants in Washington, D.C. laying the groundwork to set the blame for conservatives and Tea Party people being the cause of Romney's loss.
You are in the state of Georgia, where the Representative Paul Brown has announced his interest in running for the seat, Senate seat, being vacated by Saxe Chambliss. Brown has been saying that evolution, embryology, and the Big Bang theory, all of those are lies straight from the pit of hell. Joni Beth Martin, is that the kind of thing that a candidate ought to be saying at this point, or is it liable to make him unelectable in November?
I don't even talk about those issues. We stick to the fiscal issues. Those are the issues we need to be addressing, and the constitutional issues. And we need to look at the candidates' voting records.
Jonathan Collegio, back to you. American Crossroads and Crossroads GPS raised $300 million last year, didn't have a great rate of return in election victories. What makes you think now that you can pick the right candidates this time out, as opposed to what Joni Beth Martin says about letting people do that on a local grassroots level?
What we really want to guard against is a case where somebody is graduating through the primary who has problems that make the candidate unelectable. An example here would be the nomination of Christine O'Donnell as the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate in 2010, and then shortly after, it's found out that she dabbled in witchcraft and ended up being one of the more bizarre Senate races in memory. Those are the types of things that we want to guard against. You can talk about Crossroads' record. We did not have the record that we wanted to have last time. That was largely because we invested heavily in the presidential and it didn't pan out. But we've been at this for a long time, and our goal here is to shift the composition of the Congress rightward. That's what we want to do, both the Republican Party and generally. And the way that you have to do that, the only way that we can really stop the president's agenda is to elect folks that can go in and stop the president's agenda. Had we won more seats, had we won those 4 to 7 seats over the last two election cycles, we could have stopped the fiscal cliff tax hikes in January. But that requires winning elections, and that's what we're trying to do.
If a candidate like Mr. Brown in Georgia says that what others regard as science, embryology, for example, evolution, are in fact the work of the devil, is that the sort of thing that concerns you? Or are you afraid that a candidate like that might be subject to losing if he gets into the general election against a Democrat?
I don't know enough about Mr. Brown to comment on him. One thing that we want to make sure.
Well, we know he said those things.
I don't know the context of it. I would hate to comment on something. Okay. I don't know fully about. But what I do know is that we need to make sure that a full picture of the candidate is available to primary voters before the candidate goes into the general. Because if there are things that make the candidate unpalatable in a general election, the Democrats will get that information out. That's the most critical thing here. If there is information like that is sitting on the back burner and it's not made available to Republican primary voters, we could end up, it's not like the Democrats aren't going to use information like that. That's why it's critical to give a full picture of these folks. So we really want to elect conservative candidates here, but we need to make sure that they can win the generals as well.
Let me introduce a final voice into this conversation. Sam Tannenhaus is editor of the New York Times Book Review. He's author of an article recently published in the New Republic called Original Sin, Why the GOP is and will continue to be the party of white people. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, good to be with you.
This is said to be one of the major problems facing the Republican Party, in as much as the electorate itself is now becoming much more diverse. And we have seen Marco Rubio, for example, who we heard from briefly a bit earlier, called the savior of the Republican Party. That's what the Time magazine cover had him pegged as. Give us the history of this and why you think in the future the party is slated to be and continue to be the party of white people.
Well, first of all, let's hope that that's not the case, that it's not preordained or predestined that non-white people will be Republicans. Of course, a number of them are already. The trouble is that the percentages are so low in an increasingly diversified culture. You know, one of the most remarkable details that in the latest census, you know, as it gets released month after month, we get more information, is the number of mixed race people who claim to be of more than one ethnicity. I think it's particularly high among Asian Americans, with African Americans following behind. That is to say, they're marrying outside the group into a different group. What that does is to complicate even more some of the polarities we have in our politics. And I think part of the trouble the GOP has had for several cycles now, really a generation or more, is that the appeal seems to be aimed at, or at least is most is received most enthusiastically by white people. Now, that doesn't mean that there's anything inherent in conservative ideology that can't appeal to people of color, or let's say also young people and unmarried women, you know, these very large sectors in the electorate. What it means is that a cultural message gets through somehow that is alienating those voters. And what conservatives will have to think about, and the party itself will have to think about, is what aspects of their message, when they talk even about, when conservatives talk about freedom, what exactly do they mean by freedom? I don't think there's anyone in America who would say he or she wants to live in a country that's less free. But when you use the word freedom, what's the connotation? What exactly do you mean by that? What exactly do you mean by free markets when we live in a country that has a mixed economy and has had one for many generations? The economy is too complex to operate entirely on its own. So we know that, yes, there's always going to be some regulation. Well, regulation on whose behalf and toward what end? What I'm saying is that certain doctrinal elements of conservatism don't seem to play beyond what's an increasingly dwindling base, and that's where the problem's going to come in.
We heard Jenny Beth Martin with the Tea Party Patriots say that not only do they favor free markets, but also constitutional law and fiscal responsibility. It would seem to me, is fiscal responsibility also one of those things that can be ambiguous, particularly to people who might want to depend on government programs?
Well, sure. What exactly do we mean by fiscal responsibility? I mean, do we mean an economy that doesn't look to, you know, the real issue ahead of us that everyone seems to agree, which is joblessness? Well, how do you stimulate the economy so there are more jobs? Or if you say a constitutionally limited government, well, what do we mean exactly by that? You know, some of the writings I've written about, not for this particular essay you mentioned, but in other places, including some that come from Tea Party aligned groups, talk about, you know, repealing the 17th Amendment, the direct election of senators. Is that our idea of a constitutionally limited government? Do we mean elevating the 10th Amendment above others when the 10th Amendment is historically allied with states' rights and is really grounded, as I wrote in my essay, on the politics of nullification and John C. Calhoun, the defender of the South? Is that what we mean by a limited constitutional government? Those terms, that idiom, has become alienating to a lot of voters. There's a remarkable thing. I'll just add one more thing here, that a great political writer and thinker, Richard Goodwin, said in 1967, after he had worked for John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, he said, conservatives have a genius for semantics. Instead of national health insurance, you call it socialized medicine. Instead of labor laws that, a certain minimum wage, you say right to work. Well, that genius of semantics seems to have deserted the right for now.
Let me go back to Jenny Beth Martin and say I don't have time, unfortunately, on this program to let you go through each of these different issues individually. But let me just ask you if, in general, given the change in the electorate and the fact that it has become diverse, are you concerned about the kind of issue that Sam Tannenhaus is raising, that if you use certain kinds of terminology that is ambiguous and it can be interpreted in different ways, and that there might be a risk there to the Republican Party if you're trying to win elections? Can you just respond to that briefly, if you will?
Well, I would say first that the Tea Party has a better record of diversity than the editors of the New Republic. We need to make sure that we do convey what we mean by freedom. We want people to be free. We want them to be able to move out of minimum wage and become wealthier, move into middle class, and be rich even. That's what I want to see, and I want all Americans to have that opportunity. So we do need to be able to compete with that. And I would say, as I look back on the last election, I say, how do we convey what we mean by freedom when the opposition is saying, we'll give you free birth control, free health care, free this, free that, free college tuition, free, 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 free? How do we compete when they're giving away all these freebies with what freedom means? I would thought there is no such thing as a free lunch, and we're all going to have to pay for this debt one way or the other.
Sam Tannenhaus, are those things that are likely to have an appeal for the great diversity of voters?
Well, not only won't it have an appeal to them, it won't have much appeal to the people who are already in the Republican Party. First of all, I don't think anybody's offering free tuition to for college. If so, that will be a remarkable thing to see. If back in the Reagan years, when he came into office as someone who was going to shrink the government, we know what happened instead. Government expanded enormously. And one reason is that Reagan realistically saw that it's one thing to talk about government being intrusive. It's another thing to tell a middle-class person in any state in this country that, well, the government is not going to help a little bit with your son or daughter's college tuition.
Okay, let me quickly go. I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm sorry, in the interest of time. Jonathan Collegio, very briefly, does that help to define the kind of distinction you're trying to make between candidates who are qualified and those who aren't?
No, I don't think so. I tend to think I disagree with Sam in that it's a message thing. I think a lot of our issue with minority candidates with minority voters and reaching out is just the fact that we're not doing it. I mean, Jan van Lohuizen, who's a prominent Republican pollster, put together a really interesting memo a couple of months ago, and he said there are basically three issues that we have to conquer as a party. First, there is a policy challenge, especially with the Hispanic vote, on immigration and healthcare and all those issues. But there's also a question of rhetoric and style, how we're approaching the language. That does need to be solved. But then the third part, and what I think is the biggest part, is just showing up, treating a September 16th rally in the same way, for an elected representative at a Mexican Independence Day festival, the same way as you would treat a Memorial Day parade or something like
okay.
that. And I feel like our guys are not going out there and engaging those populations as actively as they should.
Okay, a preliminary discussion of what's going on in the Republican Party. We'll take it up again as time goes on. Sorry we've run out of time, but thank you all very much for being on our program. Jonathan Collegio of American Crossroads, Jenny Beth Martin of the Tea Party Patriots, Sam Tannenhaus, article in the New Republic. He is the editor of the New York Times Book Review. Sorry we had so short a time for you. And also Ron Brownstein with the National Journal Group. Good to have all of you on our program, and thanks very much for joining us. The asteroid called 2012 DA14 may not have a scary name, but if it were to strike planet Earth, the destruction could be colossal. Back in a moment with news that is reassuring, at least for now, on To the Point.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app.
KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. An asteroid that struck the Earth is blamed for ending the age of the dinosaurs. Others have caused enormous craters on several continents. About 1 million such rocks are orbiting in the solar system, but such a collision is very rare. Tomorrow, 2012 DA-14 will come closer to Earth than stationary GPS satellites, and astronomers are hoping to learn some lessons. Phil Plate writes the Bad Astronomer blog for Slate.com. He himself is an astronomer, and it's good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Okay, tell us, first of all, if you will, a little bit more about 2012 DA-14. How big is it? How much damage might it cause if it were to hit the Earth?
Right, the asteroid is a rock. It's about 50 yards across, so about half the size of a football field. And let me be very clear, it's going to miss. It's
okay.
Not going to hit us.
I want to make that very clear.
Yeah, it's a close shave. It's going to miss us by about 17,000 miles, or about twice the diameter of the Earth. So it is pretty close as these go. And the reason we are concerned about these kinds of asteroids is because if they do hit the Earth, they release a huge amount of energy. They explode, essentially. And something this size, we think, caused the asteroid crater impact in Arizona, a meteor crater, and also something roughly this size blew up over Siberia in 1908 in what's called the Tunguska blast. Both of these were the equivalent of several million tons of TNT exploding. So you can imagine if that happened, well, anywhere on Earth, but over a city or something like that, it would be really bad. So we feel that we need to keep our eyes on these asteroids and understand them better.
What do you hope to learn from this near passage tomorrow?
Well, the good thing about this pass is that it's quite close, but not an impact. So, you know, yay, it's not going to hit us. The good news is we have enough telescopes on it that we'll be able to, first of all, learn how to coordinate that many observations and be able to characterize how close this thing is going to pass. Now, it's going to miss 17,000 miles roughly, but is that really 16,920 or 17,104 or whatever? By measuring the orbit, the exact position of this thing, the velocity, and exactly where it passes us, we can then nail down its orbit much more accurately and be able to predict where it's going to be in the future. And let me add, we know it's not going to hit us anytime soon. It'll pass us again in the 2040s, so in about 30 years. We know it's going to miss by a long way then. But also, just being able to figure out the orbit really, really accurately means every time an asteroid comes by, we'll be able to do this. We'll learn more on how to do this and hopefully be able to get a better list of asteroids that get near the Earth in the future.
It's my understanding there are about 10,000 that have been observed.
Something like that, right. And out of that number, we think, let me invert that. We think that that number is out of roughly a million asteroids as big as DA-14 or bigger that get near the Earth. So there are a lot of these things out there. They don't hit us very often. You don't get a pass this close by an object this size except every few decades. They don't hit us except every few hundred years. It's not like this is going to happen, you know, tonight, but it's something we need to understand. This is an actual threat. Given enough time, these things will hit us. We need to know where they are, where they're headed, which ones are coming by in the near future, like in the next, you know, few decades, so that if we do see one with our number on it, we can do something about it.
How long a time would we have to do something about it? If you have seen 10,000, if there are roughly a million out there, and you kind of have to wait until this one gets within 17,000 miles to figure out exactly where it's going.
Well, we're actually observing it now, and we're getting a better orbit on it even as we speak. And there are going to be, for example, a telescope that's going to ping it with radio waves, like a cop's radar gun, and that'll really nail down its orbit quite well.
Okay.
So they don't have to be this close to do that. But you're right. We've only seen 1% of these objects. And we need to characterize all of these orbits so that we can make sure that nothing out there is going to threaten us. Now, it might be a lot of these times they're small and faint and dim. This one's passing 17,000 miles away, very close. And yet, if you're on if you're in Australia or Europe, you'd need binoculars to see it because it's so small. So ones that are farther away are even fainter. We need big telescopes. We need to be mapping out huge sections of the sky. And we're doing that, but we need even more eyes on the sky so that we can find all of these objects. We don't think there's one that's going to hit this anytime soon, but a lot of the times these things aren't discovered until they've already passed us. I don't want to terrify anybody, but that's usually the case. And we need to be watching these things better so that we can have more of a lead time in case one of them is headed our way.
Okay, let's emphasize again, this one will not hit us, will not hit us, will not hit us. But where can you watch it? Or is it possible to be seen from anywhere in the United States, for example?
Well, unfortunately, we have our back turned to it. We're facing the sun when this thing passes by, so it's going to be up during the it's up during our daytime on the other side of the Earth. So if you happen to be in Europe, Australia, or Asia, you can see it. In America, we're going to have to wait until after sunset, which is long after this thing passes, but it'll still be in the sky. The problem is it'll be much farther away, so it'll be fainter. If you go online and look for, you know, where will DA14 be, you'll find some websites that can give you coordinates, but you know, you have to have a telescope and kind of know what you're doing to be able to see this thing at all. Your best bet is to find a telescope that's observing it and posting the pictures online. And I'm hoping to have a list of a few more observatories on my blog by tomorrow when that happens.
Is this the kind of asteroid that might be useful for mining?
Yes and no. It's big enough that it might have some interesting things on it, metals or maybe not water, but probably in the rock there are elements we can use like oxygen to make air for astronauts and things like that. This specific rock, though, is on an orbit which swings it past the Earth at a speed of about 5 miles per second. That's about 10 times faster than a rifle bullet. So it's not terribly useful for mining because you'd have to catch up with it and land on it and then somehow get that material into a useful orbit.
So, kind of hard to get on board.
Yeah, when it's moving that fast, yeah.
Okay, so once again, it's not going to strike the Earth, and it's going to nonetheless come closer than some of our satellites. That's pretty close.
Yeah, and there are pictures of it online. You can find it if you dig around. It's just a dot of light, but it's still pretty interesting to see something like this. We don't get a chance to see an asteroid come this close very often.
Phil Plait, astronomer, writes the Bad Astronomer blog for Slate. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Special thanks to Lila Thayer. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.